Hello, and welcome to A History of Japan.
Season 10, Episode 13, The Imjin War, Part 3, Scorched Earth. Although most of the remnants of the official army of Chosun were killed at the Battle of Imjin River, this did not mean that the nation was entirely helpless. Previous invasions by Khitans and later the Yuan Empire had resulted in the temporary formation of Weibyong, or righteous armies. These were generally small militias who undertook guerrilla campaigns against the occupying forces, striking them at weak points and occasionally coalescing into larger groups capable of more effective collective action. Among the ranks of these patriot militias were former officers in the now-defunct Chosun military, untrained peasants eager to fight, Buddhist monks who trained as warriors, and even scholar officials who set their Confucian debates aside during the national crisis and took up swords and bows instead. As the central and eastern portions of the Korean peninsula fell before a rapid, concerted Japanese advance, the western portion became extremely active in grassroots resistance dedicated to driving the invaders away. While the Japanese occupation of Korea, which began in 1592, would stretch on for many years, the Weibyong were a significant factor in the eventual failure of the Japanese invasion. The formation of such groups allegedly baffled the Japanese, who tended to surrender when their leaders surrendered or were killed in battle. However, I think it more likely that the leaders of the Japanese invasion saw the Weibyong as being similar to the Ikko Ikki, who had, until recently, used grassroots power to cause major disruptions. Regardless of how the samurai and their ashigaru subordinates saw the Weibyong, they would soon learn just how dangerous a coordinated insurgent militia could be to their empire-building ambitions. While countless encounters in which small contingents of the righteous army would ambush supply carts and ashigaru patrols no doubt went unrecorded, their larger actions are a source of national fame. In early June of 1592, near the beginning of the invasion, Japanese forces seized the important city of Cheongju, a critical center of provincial administration which possessed a considerable granary. A large group of Weibyong gathered under the command of Zhou Han, a scholar official and member of the Westerner faction, who had forewarned about the potential for Japanese invasion. In fact, Zhou Han had advocated for a preemptive strike against Japan years before the invasion began, a suggestion which was rejected out of hand at the time. It seems that attacks on Japanese supply, both by righteous army contingents and seaborne raids, were starting to have an effect on divisions deep within the nation's interior, like those stationed in Cheongju. When Zhou Han assembled his army of around 2,500 Weibyong troops in September of 1592, the Japanese forces were spread over the surrounding countryside foraging for food. Seeing that his forces had the element of surprise, he ordered them to charge. As the attack began, the Japanese defenders attempted to form up and fire their arquebuses, but by the time they managed to squeeze off their first shot, the Weibyong were close enough for the arquebusiers to be in range of their bows. They loosed clouds of arrows into the Japanese ranks, causing them to quickly break and run. The invaders attempted to make a counteroffensive, but a heavy rain began to fall, and Zhou Han opted to retreat. When his forces returned to Cheongju the next day, the city had been abandoned, and so they reclaimed it. The withdrawal of the Japanese troops from Cheongju after a brief but bloody skirmish seems to suggest that their leaders were concerned not only with problems in their supply lines, but also worried about the growing righteous army movement. The Battle of Cheongju was an important milestone for Korean resistance, and the ranks of the Weibyong swelled as the prospect of driving the Japanese invaders off the peninsula suddenly seemed possible. Unfortunately for those who followed Zhou Han, this victory would be somewhat short-lived. Another commander of the Weibyong originally planned to link with Zhou Han and combine forces, but instead he attempted to take the Japanese base at Gumsan and lost his life in the ensuing battle. Zhou Han decided to try and avenge his death by following up his success at Cheongju by taking Gumsan. The commander of Gimson's garrison was well informed of the Righteous Army's movements, however, and decided to attack them in the field since that particular Weibyang force was small enough for the Japanese to encircle. In the ensuing battle, many of the Righteous Army were killed, including Johan. Nevertheless, the resistance continued. In early October 1592, the Weibyang forces in northern Korea reinforced Yeonan Fortress in the peninsula's center. Although the Japanese had taken Pyongyang and Kaesong, they were already overstretching their supply lines on the southern coast. North of Yeonan Fortress was a city with a massive granary which might assist in their efforts of conquest, if they could get to it. To do so, they would need to take Yeonan, a small but well-fortified castle which enjoyed some recent improvements thanks to the late Johan, who had arranged for repairs and upgrades the year before the invasion. Leading the Japanese forces attempting to seize Yeonan was Kuroda Nagamasa, the son of famed strategist Kuroda Kanbei. He sent an envoy to plead with the garrison commanders to surrender, promising clemency for their troops. The leaders responded, "You fight with soldiers, but we fight with righteousness." Thus, the stage was set for a siege. The Koreans enjoyed one large advantage over the Japanese. This was their home turf, and in the case of Yeonan Fortress, they were well supplied. While years-long sieges were possible in Japan, the constant destruction of infrastructure and the ambushes of irregular troops directly against their supply line meant that they would have little choice but to opt for assault. The Japanese invaders attempted to scale the walls of the fortress, shooting their arquebuses at the defenders armed with bows. The defending archers were ordered not to try and return fire against the arquebusiers who were out of their range, but to focus their efforts against the men scaling the walls. Over the next several days, ferocious battle ensued as the Japanese continually attempted new stratagems for taking the fortress, and the Weibyang inside the castle gradually saw their weapons depleted. In spite of the fact that they had run out of arrows and were thus reduced to throwing spears, swords, rocks, and whatever else they could get a hold of, the defenders of Yeonan stood firm against a concerted, determined attack. In the moment, however, their situation still seemed dire. The Righteous Army leader, Yi Jong-am, made a pile of firewood and sat atop it, telling his son to light the bonfire if the fortress fell, saying he would rather burn to death than be killed by the Japanese. While certainly a dramatic gesture, it would prove unnecessary. In the dead of night on October 6th, some Weibyang members snuck out of the castle with bundles of straw, which they set among the Japanese tents in secret. They lit the bundles on fire, which quickly spread into a great conflagration that threatened to incinerate the Japanese camp. By this point, casualties for Commander Kuroda Nagamasa were beginning to mount, and it's believed that his army lost about half its number in the repeated attempts to seize Yeonan Fortress. The next morning, with his forces scattered from the confusion of the night before, he ordered a withdrawal. The Korean defenders' account claims that they had only lost 31 of their own number, while Japanese accounts record that almost half of the 3,000 who came to seize Yeonan died in the attempt. A little before the dramatic attempt to take Yeonan Fortress, a series of skirmishes, sieges, and ambushes began in northeastern Hamgyong province, which borders Manchuria on the north. The situation in Hamgyong was complicated by its ethnic demographics. You may recall from the Korea-centric episode way back in Season 6 that during the Goryeo dynasty, many Khitans and Manchurian peoples emigrated to the northern provinces of Korea, and their descendants formed a kind of untouchable class who were tasked with supposedly dirty jobs. The Baekjeong, as they were called, faced discrimination from the Korean government in spite of King Sejong's attempt to more fully integrate them into their society. By this time in the history of the Joseon dynasty, the name Baekjeong had a pejorative connotation and was often used as a denigrating insult. Using the timeless logic of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, some of the Baekjeong of Hamgyong province opted to join with the Japanese invaders. Across the border, some Jurchens likewise offered their support to the Japanese. The leader of that particular branch of the invasion was Kato Kiyomasa, a Nichiren Buddhist whose battle standards had a quote from Nichiren inscribed upon them, which translates to, "Hail to the Lotus of the Divine Law." The army directly under his command numbered around 22,000 and had been conquering its way up the eastern portion of the Korean peninsula. Although some of the marginalized residents of Hamgyong province joined with the invaders, many of the Korean residents formed their own Weebyong and prepared to counter the Japanese advance. The leader of this particular righteous army was Jong Moon-bu, an officer in the existing military whose talent for guerrilla warfare would be uncovered throughout the course of the Imjin War. Some local officials in Hamgyong province, clearly believing that the final conquest of Korea was imminent, chose to cozy up to the Japanese invaders by handing over two princes of the royal family, including the king's eldest son, to Kato Kiyomasa. The Weebyong under Jong Moon-bu's command were infuriated at this betrayal, and he made it a priority to capture those faithless officials and execute them for treason. After the executions, they set to work destabilizing the Japanese positions and harassing their supply line. The righteous army of Hamgyong besieged the fortress of Kilchu, surrounding it with three separate detachments. One platoon of Japanese soldiers had just pillaged a nearby town and was returning to Kilchu, where they were stationed. They were ambushed en route and killed to a man. The defenders attempted several sorties, but they all failed, and the Weebyong held the line. In late January of 1593, Kato Kiyomasa received word that Kilchu Fortress might really be in danger, so he took his army of 20,000 to relieve the siege and bring the matter to an end. Jong Moon-bu withdrew his force, which was probably around 5,000 strong, and they proceeded to ambush Kiyomasa's forces, which were spread thin, inflicting heavy losses on the Japanese invaders. When Kiyomasa met with his general to determine their total losses, they tallied the reports and found that they had suffered over 8,000 casualties. Kiyomasa withdrew from Hamgyong province for the moment, intent on returning with reinforcements. The Battle of Bukgwan, as it was later called, was a resounding success for Korean resistance nationwide. Although it was not a decisive defeat for the Japanese, it certainly gave the invasion's leaders pause to consider that the local population was not as helpless and incompetent as they had been led to believe. Even as early as late 1592, there were signs that this invasion might not work out the way the Japanese had hoped. A fortress called Chinchu on the central southern coast of Korea held firm against Japanese onslaught, and casualties mounted until finally they had to withdraw. Busan, the first major city taken at the invasion's beginning, was bombarded with cannon fire from a Korean fleet under Admiral Yi Sun-shin, which sank over 100 Japanese ships. In early 1593, everything changed when more armies from Ming China began to arrive. This time, in much larger numbers than the paltry forces which had come previously. In fact, it is possible that their relatively easy victory over said paltry forces gave the Japanese troops on the ground a fatal overconfidence in their own ferocity compared to the martial might of the Ming dynasty. Although the rulers of China had not initially sent their best troops to support the Koreans in their time of need, they were about to make up for those earlier shortcomings in a big way. Armed with their own arquebuses, cannon, and other gunpowder weaponry, the Ming army utilized the mixed units originally conceived by the late General Qi Jiguang. In fact, one of Qi Jiguang's disciples who would lead Chinese troops into battle against the Japanese in Korea, one Wu Weizhong, was part of the Chinese army facing off against the Japanese army ensconced in Pyongyang in February of 1593. The Japanese had seized the historically important city of Pyongyang early in the invasion, and their ability to defend such fortifications against attempted assaults by the Weebyong was well documented. The Ming armies, however, made extensive use of fire arrows and other such weapons whose primary objective was to spread panic among the enemy rather than causing casualties outright. This coalition army was composed of a Chinese force of around 43,000 along with 10,000 Korean auxiliaries. The ensuing assault was brutal and bloody. The Ming forces charged the walls of Pyongyang with ladders as fire arrows covered their advance. Once they were climbing, however, they were subject to arquebus fire from the defenders. The struggle for control of the wall was contentious, and the two sides seemed evenly matched, but eventually the attackers were bunched up at the base of the wall and were killed in huge numbers by arquebus volleys from those atop the wall. Although the Japanese forces held the city against repeated concerted assaults from the joint Ming-Joseon army, they had lost close to 2,000 troops so far, and the fires sparked within the city by the attack killed many more, possibly up to 5,000 additional troops. While the combat losses of the Ming-Joseon army was similar, around 1,500 or so, they had gotten frighteningly close to seizing the walls and taking the city already. If reinforcements came, the defenders wouldn't stand a chance. In the dead of night on February 8, 1593, Konishi Yukinaga arranged a hasty but organized withdrawal. The Japanese forces, still reeling in the grim aftermath of the carnage, left the dead where they lay and abandoned anyone unable to walk on their own. According to one account, some of the wounded attempted to follow their compatriots by crawling. Any Japanese warriors still alive in Pyongyang were later summarily executed by the Ming Chosun forces, who occupied the city when they realized the Japanese had left. The losses at the second siege of Pyongyang for the Japanese troops were staggering. The war dead combined with the wounded left behind and those who died in the fires that spread throughout the city totaled more than 10,000. While not the first time the Japanese had been defeated in Korea during this invasion, this was by far the worst defeat they had endured thus far, and created a new source of turmoil within the Japanese leadership. Because Konishi Yukinaga was the ranking general charged with defending Pyongyang, most of the blame fell on him. Kuroda Yoshitaka wrote to Hideyoshi, requesting that Yukinaga be removed from his position as expedition leader, saying that he was ineffective, and that he did not work well with the other generals. Although they had come to Korea together, the various high-ranking commanders of the expedition were not above the petty rivalry typical of the daimyo class. Yukinaga, for his part, became a strenuous advocate for making peace with both Chosun and Ming, believing that disaster was about to fall on the Japanese army in Korea if the war proceeded on its present course. His advice went largely unheeded, and the joint Ming-Joseon forces continued to gain momentum. Shortly after their victory at Pyongyang and the subsequent Japanese withdrawal, they captured the city of Kaesong as well as most of the provincial capitals in the northern half of the peninsula. The Chinese and Korean troops prepared to strike for Hansong, believing that the former capital city was being defended by only 10,000 Japanese soldiers. The Chinese general Li Rusong, a decorated veteran of the recent anti-rebellion campaigns of the Ningxia region in northern China, led a scouting expedition of the area with around 3,000 of his own troops. This was not meant to be an actual strike force, but a reconnaissance mission to gather information and prepare for a future incursion. The invasion itself had so thoroughly destroyed Korea's infrastructure and food supply that the Ming armies which came to support them were unable to muster larger numbers in some areas for fear that they would need to consume literally all of the available food. Li Rusong advanced toward the area around Hansong with his 3,000, half of which were cavalry, in late February 1593. They encountered a Japanese patrol of 5,000 and lured them into a pursuit with a false retreat, then ambushed the unfortunate patrol with Korean rocket batteries and killed about 100. However, while this patrol had stumbled into a trap, they were not the only Japanese force in the area. Another band of 2,000, upon hearing that a Chinese army was marching through the area, soon arrived and engaged the Ming Chosun army on their right flank. The battle proceeded with feints, false retreats, ambushes, and reinforcements arriving to support both sides. The Ming reinforcements, however, were only about 2,000, while the Japanese reinforcements, which seemed to continually arrive, eventually numbered around a whopping 40,000. The battle had gone poorly for the Chinese and Korean troops, but thanks to possessing defensible terrain, they were able to withdraw without succumbing to a rout. They lost half their forces, however, and this fairly devastating defeat caused Li Rusong and his fellow Chinese generals to reconsider their previously held prejudices regarding the inferiority of Japanese troops. Fearing a larger follow-up attack, Japanese forces in Hansong burned all the grass they could find in the vicinity, hoping to deny much-needed food to the Ming cavalry if they struck for the former capital. Seeking to improve their position in Hansong and prevent an impending Ming invasion, Konishi Yukinaga led an army of 30,000 westwards from the city to attack a riverbank fortress called Hangju. This rundown fortification had been reclaimed by one Guang Yul, a Chosun general who had won fame for himself by gaining victories over Japanese advance forces attempting to seize the southwestern province of Chawla. Hangju Fortress was just close enough to Hansong to become a real problem if it was rebuilt and in enemy hands, so the Japanese army stationed there was determined to drive the Koreans out. They marshaled a force of around 30,000 and approached the castle, which was defended by about 2,300 Korean forces. It is clear that the Japanese intended to simply overrun Hangju Fortress with wave after wave of assault. However, that would prove more difficult than they imagined. The fortress of Hangju was located on a cliff overlooking the Han River. This meant that it could only be approached from one narrow side, and that its garrison could be supplied by boats. In mid-March of 1593, the Japanese army marched on Hangju, attempting several times to send assault teams to breach its walls. The defenders were a little better armed than previous Chosun armies. In addition to bows, which were very effective in fortified defensive engagement, they also possessed some cannons and hwacha, the Korean missile batteries which could launch 100 to 200 rocket-driven arrows at a time. After the first three attempts were pushed back, disaster nearly struck for the defenders as their outer defenses were breached by a force led by Ukita Hideye. When he was wounded, however, his forces fell back to get him to safety, and the defenders retook the outer defenses and hurriedly repaired the breaches as they harried the retreating Japanese warriors. The battle continued until dusk, at which point the Japanese decided to retreat. It is remarkable that a Korean army of only a little over 2,000 was able to stem the tide against the Japanese force 15 times the size of their own number. Granted, castle assaults can sometimes have these incredible sorts of outcomes, but Gwangyul absolutely deserves a place among the most able generals in Korean history. Official casualties among the Japanese was only 110, but there is simply no way this number is accurate. Because they had the luxury of an orderly retreat, the dead were carried back to Hansong and received proper funeral rites, and it's generally understood that the losses of the attacking force must have been significant. Meanwhile, in the absence of a sizable force at Hansong, Ming Chosun raiding parties had torched the outlying granaries and other sources of supply. A few days after the Battle of Hangju, Konishi Yukinaga negotiated with the Ming generals for a withdrawal from Hansong, to which they agreed. The Japanese abandoned Hansong, and the Ming and Chosun forces took up residence soon after. The residents within the fortress were described by the newly arrived liberators as looking like ghosts. Doubtless they were emaciated, starved, and traumatized from the abusive and exploitative Japanese occupation. In the spring of 1593, the tide appeared to be turning against the Japanese in the Imjin War. Most of the north was back under Chosun's jurisdiction, and the capital Hansong was back in Korean hands as well. Sort of. Unfortunately for the residents of the Korean Peninsula, hosting the Ming armies on their soil was not a pleasant experience, even if they were ostensibly defending them from an invading force. Next time, we will conclude the Imjin War as stalemate ensued, peace was discussed, accepted, rejected, and some of the most horrific atrocities of the war would occur.
Until then, thank you for listening. If you would like access to exclusive bonus episodes, as well as ad-free versions of the regular episodes, please consider supporting this podcast at patreon.com/ahistoryofjapan.